The 2012 Living Planet Report has just been released by the World Wildlife Fund, and it reveals some disturbing global environmental trends. Joining us now is Kate Newman, the Managing Director of Public Sector Initiatives and Field Programs at the WWF. Welcome to our show for today's Backstory segment.
Hey, thank you very much, Leonard. Nice to be there.
Overall, is the situation getting worse or better for the Earth's ecosystems?
Well, generally, it's getting worse, and it's getting better at the same time in some places. There's plenty of hope, but we need to pay attention. I think that's the big story here. And actually, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to frame things in a little New York story for you. I'm just figuring I'm here in D.C. and you're in New York, and I come from a long line of New York City folk, and some of the solutions are actually coming right out of New York City. It's hard to imagine, but when I go around the world, all the time people say, hey, New York, that water is the best in the world. And just as my grandmother used to say, New York's the greatest city in the world, and sure enough, you've produced some of the most modern and most, it's a model of water management globally. So we need to see models like that being applied everywhere.
So what are we doing here that's so great?
You're actually managing your water in collaboration with your neighbors. So upstate New York, in the Catskills and in Connecticut, water management has been a heritage from long ways back, a negotiation with the city to basically protect the water resources in the reserves, the water, water reserves, and that allows New York to be able to have clean, fresh water coming in without much treatment. Very rare.
Although the city is concerned about the growing movement to have fracking upstate, I had a guest recently who said that cities like New York are actually positive for the future of the planet because urbanization is more efficient. Is that true?
Absolutely. I was actually going to get to that very point, thinking about New York. One of the models that we need to be promoting more and more is anti-sprawl, as we say in the U.S., or consolidation of the population that's spreading across the planet. It's absolutely more efficient, and it's going to have to be the model of the future. So when people talk about green cities today, one of the examples that they'll give is bringing people to core areas, providing all the services locally, managing your resources locally, and enabling people to live happy, comfortable lives without using all the natural system inefficiently that our resources need to come from. So, in fact, your founding fathers of New York thought of that ages ago and started the model, at least with water, right from the get-go.
But the trend worldwide is for people to move to cities, and we see in places like China a fishing village suddenly becoming a city of 20 million. Are they all efficient, or is New York a special case?
No, it's generally a principle that we need to be bringing people into areas closer together to provide services more efficiently. Not every city is reaching that level of efficiency quite yet. But if we step back and think about what we need to be doing into the future, cities are one of the solutions. And I just was going to also note that the beginning of our book called The Living Planet Report has a front piece from an astronaut. And he's Andre Kiepers from the European Space Agency is providing our opening remarks. And I think that's an important way to look at this issue. The planet is pretty small, and it's astronauts who get to see it from that point of view, and they're the ones who can sort of put some perspective out there for us to understand the limitation. It's one lonely blue planet all by itself out there, and that's all we've got.
Is it also a question of where the city is located? I'm thinking about Los Angeles, which is in an area that can't be all that efficient because It's not near good resources. It has to import its water from a lot further away than New York has to import its. It is pretty much located on a desert. It also has the possibility of earthquakes. And that's in the United States. I'd imagine that in some of the larger cities of the world, which are just have all the shanty towns that are growing up around them, that the situation is pretty awful, and overpopulation it may be a key factor in all of that.
You're absolutely right. It's the history of where we put our cities, and it's tended to be along coastlines, is going to be a problem for us in the future. The coastlines are going to be experiencing a lot of change with climate change coming on. It's already happening in a lot of places I work, where sea level rise is going to make those cities inappropriately located. But what the world is now discussing is, okay, we've got the resources that we inherited from nature. They are irreplaceable in some cases, like water. We haven't come up with a technological solution of where we're going to get more water. So we need to be thinking about how we can maintain water flow, water access, where it comes from. We have to understand, where does water come from and why does it continue to flow, which could you lead you upstream into forest areas and mountains and glaciers, and really understanding the Earth as a system that functions as a complex, organized system, and everything needs its supply to be managed. We have to step back and become better and more sort of, let's say, deeper understanding stewards. So what that's going to lead to is looking at your question of where to put the people, where to put the cities. We need to be looking at where our most efficient access to resources is going to be, the least carbon consuming ways of organizing cities, and where human populations live. And probably one of the most important things people are worrying about right now is, where are we going to get the food from? And that's going to require space. We need to have land to produce our food, and we need to be able to organize our food production much more efficiently than we do now.
Well, this leads me to two questions. First of all, agriculture depends on fresh water being used to water crops, and we are losing our freshwater sources. Our aquifers are emptying out. And second of all, to get more land, we are clearing places like the Amazon, where which we consider to be the lungs of the earth. So, is that trade-off creating an impossible situation?
Creating a situation where we need to be better managers. We need to manage the earth as we would manage a business. Coming up soon is what we call Rio Plus 20, but it's the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. 20 years ago, it was called the Earth Summit, and we're going to be talking about sustainable development. And this time, the theme is green economies. And the term green economies was brought into play by the UN Environment Program, mainly to help decision makers think about how we use our resources from a manager's point of view, from an economic point of view. Using words like biodiversity, which of course WWF does all the time, or even the word nature, kind of puts those issues aside. Those are for the greenies to talk about. We need to talk business serious. We need to talk about the future. So now we're talking about all these natural resources as assets. It's our natural capital. It's the means we have to create our wealth and our prosperity and our future. So what if you think of things that way, and you look at what the Living Planet Report's telling us, we inherited this wealth from nature. We can't recreate it. It doesn't come back, especially the dead resources like oil and gas. Living resources can be replenished, but tropical forests like the ones you're describing, the biodiversity, generally can't come back in the way that it was. Once it's gone, that asset has been drawn down to zero, and it's not going to be replaced. Can we rethink how we manage our assets, our natural capital, so that they continue to provide returns to humanity forever. And that's going to require a different way of thinking about use than we have now.
My guest is Kate Newman, Managing Director of Public Sector Initiatives at the World Wildlife Fund. We're talking about a new report issued by the WWF called Living Planet Report. And the report concludes that our footprint exceeds the Earth's biocapacity. What does that mean?
I mean, it's to continue the financial analogy for a minute. It's basically, say you have your resources for the year, your salary, your annual salary, and you're spending money as you make it. Basically, in this case, we're spending money faster than we can replenish it. And one analogy is by the time we reach September, the revenue is gone. We're no longer drawing in resources, and we're starting to deplete them, and we're basically running out of cash.
So
we're running out of resources.
So on top of the global debt crisis, we have an environmental debt crisis?
Basically. Very good analogy. Can I use that later?
Of course.
That's exactly right.
I've read that by 2030, we'll need two planet Earths to sustain the demands of the growing population if current trends continue. Is that even possible?
It's physically not possible, especially for things like water that need to be replaced, that we can't actually replace. We don't have a technical substitute for water. It reflects our carbon use. The numbers are very much about the fact that our carbon use is increasing dramatically and will continue to, and the Earth can't absorb all that. But we have to stop business as usual. That's the basic message. We're a bit blinded by our comfort and our ability to kind of solve problems normally. But what this report is really showing is we've kind of hit the limit to what kind of problems we can solve in a business-as-usual way.
Is that because of population growth? Is that the primary pressure?
Partially, but it's largely also to do with consumption patterns. For example, the book is showing that in the temperate zones where we live, the biodiversity is sort of coming back. You see increased forest cover from before, and some of the species are coming back, which is good. But they're coming back from a lower point back in history. It's what some people call a shifting baseline. We had already destroyed our resources. Our eastern United States was empty of forests in the 1800s, and we're coming back from there. But in the tropical system, we're seeing a terrible decline of biological resources, starting from the highest levels of biodiversity the Earth's ever known, and we're seeing them degrade right now. But unfortunately for the world depends on the tropical zone for a lot of our what we call ecosystem services. We get agricultural products. Palm oil, for example, is in almost every product we use these days, only grown in the tropics. We have our soy, our corn, only grown in tropical zones. Countries like Brazil, you mentioned the Amazon, because of their own regulations, they can no longer degrade the Amazon further, so they're going to Mozambique, our other countries that I work in, to plant the soy to continue to produce the beef that we eat.
So has economic development in Brazil and Russia, India, China, and South Africa, the BRICS nations, accelerated the environmental decline?
They're in the process of basically going in the direction that we did, and unfortunately the Earth doesn't have the luxury to allow that to happen. So the BRICS have to be much more aware of their impact that they're going to have if they follow, as we call it, a business-as-usual path. So some of the most important areas of the world to get things right now are going to be those BRIC nations where population growth is quite high, resource depletion is already there, and they need economic growth because they're suffering from poverty across their rural areas largely, and of course in their cities. So they have a lot of challenges for their future, but they need to do things better than the rest of the world has done before them, and they're actually thinking about it.
In the 60s and 70s, the so-called Green Revolution dramatically increased crop yields. What was the downside to that? Hasn't it reduced the amount of space needed for a human being to live on in average?
Yeah, there are several downsides. Those increases came from a lot of technological fixes, a lot of pesticides and herbicides and modified products. And they were, you know, they actually saved many countries from really abject poverty. But they do require irrigation. They require a lot of space. They have been put into areas that are not naturally suited for that kind of agriculture. So you have efforts to transform regions into what people want rather than what would be naturally appropriate for that part of the world. So we're starting to see faster degradation in areas simply because it's more convenient.
Well, are we relying on science to come up with answers like genetic engineering that some claim will lead to a second green revolution?
Absolutely. Science is going to be an essential part of our survival into the future. But science depends on nature. Most of the ideas we get for our science advancements come straight out of nature. The basic ingredients that we need to use for agriculture still is soil. We need fresh water. Science can help, and it's going to be necessary, absolutely, but it isn't going to be everything.
Although a lot of people are very concerned about the ultimate impact of GMOs, and many people in the countries where they are being pushed are resisting.
Absolutely. It's nerve-wracking. We're hitting a situation where science is reaching beyond people's sort of comfort zone of what they want to see out in their own universe, and GMOs are making a lot of people nervous. GMOs are part of a scientific process of figuring out how we're going to feed the world, and it's going to be a dialogue that we're going to have to resolve. It's very complicated to figure out where all our food's going to come from on the space we have available without technology, including science that includes things like GMOs and better pesticides and other inputs, we call them.
Go ahead.
No, it's a challenge, and it's an exciting challenge. It's one that the world is going to be talking about very much in the next month or so as we go into this Rio meeting in Brazil.
You said that biodiversity has increased in the temperate zone, but your index continues to show around a 30% global decline in biodiversity since 1970. Are we stabilizing it a little bit?
In some places we are, yes. In some places biodiversity can bounce back. Ecology is a living thing, of course, and if you manage certain areas well, you can see resources rebound, and that's apparent in some fisheries. It's apparent in our own forest system. You know the problem we have with deer. They were almost gone before. Now they're everywhere. So nature is a pretty resilient thing. But in certain parts of the world, that's not really the case. And in the tropics, they're much more fragile. Nature's system is more complicated in that certain areas hold many, many species that rely just on the exact temperature, exact rainfall, exact parameters of what a tropical system can provide. And once you mess with that, you take one of those elements out, that decline is permanent. You may lose that species forever. So the less resilient parts of the world in the tropics are the ones that are causing that global decline to be so great.
That's where the
pressure is.
Should I be surprised that the country on the top of your list of having the largest ecological footprint is Qatar?
It's a carbon-related issue, yeah. One of the biggest components of our report is accounting for the carbon emissions, carbon use of every nation because of it's part of what the world is going to have to absorb and tolerate in order to persist. So some of the countries that you see at the top of the list are heavy users or emitters of carbon.
Where does the United States fit into that picture?
We didn't make it to the top of that list, fortunately, but we are fifth in the world overall, and it's quite high. Our consumption patterns remain, not just in terms of carbon emissions, but in terms of use of all resources that we need to maintain our lifestyle, remains top of the world, and that therefore our footprint is quite strong. Our population isn't as high as some other countries, so our numbers get sort of balanced by a lower population level, but it's mainly that issue of consumption patterns around the world that bring the U.S. up the list.
You mentioned earlier the threat of climate change to the global environmental health. In this country, as you know, this is a political hot potato. So are some of the solutions, or finding solutions on a political level, going to be a little difficult?
Absolutely. In this country, we're at a standstill politically. Our two parties, our bipartisan approach to these issues has kind of stopped us in our tracks in thinking about this, and we need leadership to pull us out and make some decisions and move us forward with the rest of the world. We don't want a vacuum of leadership around this issue, and that could be what we're seeing. So coming up in this Rio meeting that I'll be attending, this is where the world's going to talk about not just things like biodiversity. We have a convention about that. We have a separate one on climate change. But this is the one about how we're going to survive. This is the one about how we are going to stay on this planet with our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and ancestors who are going to be able to live lives like we have.
Now,
it's
Kate,
called sustainable development.
I have very little time left, but I want to bring up another political hot potato. Canada is developing its oil sands. Many prominent scientists have said that exploitation of the oil sands is a game over for the climate. Do you see it that way?
If it's not managed well, it could be a source of an enormous amount of carbon emissions. We're very worried about that, absolutely.
So this is not just a problem of that the United States is, and some of the growing nations are created. We're seeing this in all over the world because people...
Absolutely. I work a lot in Mozambique, just came back from there a week ago. They are now sitting on the fifth largest gas field in the world. It's one of the poorest nations in the world. But it's being inundated by demands for things like gas and oil, things like soy to be planted in the fields to feed the cows that we need to produce our hamburgers and so on.
So what's the problem there?
It is global. It takes global leadership. It takes the world to think together around these issues. No single country, even the United States, can't manage the system alone. If you just walk down the aisles of Walmart anywhere in America, let's just say Kansas, almost every product that we get used to having every day, let's say tuna fish,
15 seconds,
comes from somewhere else in the world. We need to think about where that comes from and help those folks manage it so that we can have that for the rest of our future and for our children.
Kate Newman is the Managing Director of Public Sector Initiatives and Field Programs at the World Wildlife Fund. We've been talking about the WWF's 2012 Living Planet Report, and I thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much. It was great to be in New York.